All right. This point you're making about the creativity of Frank, the way he could create plays, he could create skits, he could do anything at the drop of a hat or be inspired by anything. When you know that I've published an interview with Frank Zappa through the medium Michael Blake Reed, who channeled the Evergreens, and the Evergreens could bring anybody in, and they brought Frank in, and I talked to Frank for a long time. You know about that interview, right?
No, I don't. Refresh my memory.
It got published in Flipside magazine in the late 90s, 96 or so, and I've been going to Michael Blake Reed for years. I could talk to anybody in history. I talked to Tim Leary when he passed on. Yeah, and I published it, and I talked to Marshall McLuhan, many hours with Marshall McLuhan, but I also did Frank Zappa. And without going too much into that, here's the point, that when Michael Blake Reed would come out of trance, he would get impressions. And in his mind, he wouldn't know what the interview, what I was getting on recording or what it was about, but he'd have some kind of dream response in his brain. And so he said, I said, what impressions did you get, Michael? He said, well, I was talking to Frank Zappa. And he then describes, he says he sees Frank really worried about setting up the sound check and all that. And then he says, they're all yelling out, what's the secret word tonight? So he actually described stuff we know about Frank. And then he said, but he goes, you know, I've never been inside someone's brain. Anybody that's being talked to through with the Evergreens. But I was inside Frank's brain, and it was huge, he said. There were whole realms of departments that he wasn't using. It wasn't like he wasn't using. Just that there was so much stuff that he could do. And he says, in his dream imagination, I asked Frank, why aren't you doing plays and all this other stuff? And
right.
And Frank says, well, the problem is the name. The name Frank Zappa has a certain stigma, and a lot of people
exactly.
won't work with me. And then Michael says, he says to Frank, why didn't you change your name? And Frank said, yeah, I thought of that, but I just never bothered to. But I was struck by the hugeness that Michael perceived of Frank's brain. I mean, people call him a genius, but there might have been more to this. And the way you said that he could come up with skits and responses to anything instantly. He was such a fountain of instant creativity. I think that's partly what Michael Blake Reed saw in the huge brain. What thoughts occur to you as I say that?
No. Say that last part again.
Yeah, Michael Blake Reed was just amazed at the potential, the capacities that were in Frank's head, that he could do anything.
Right, exactly. Sure. And what was his impression, or?
No, what is your thoughts? As I tell you this, you've already.
Well, we just went through that. I think Reed was right on. I think he was right on the money, and through a different avenue or a different route, he came to the same conclusion that I just laid out to you.
That's right.
You know, he's got Frank had that he had an innate ability to be able to do things like that. You know, that was just one of his major talents. That was one of his main talents. You know, and he was just seems to be blessed and or cursed.
Yeah.
Blessed and or cursed with that ability. You know, which made him the Frank Zappa. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So
which made him the famous Frank Zappa. You know?
Yeah, Elliot. I asked Elliot Ingber once when they first got the mothers together. I said I asked him, well, why did Frank become the leader? And Elliot says because he had the chops. And then he says, for example, one time I was with Frank. And Elliot was a real expert on blues stuff, right? He knew a lot
right.
of blues songs. And he says,
right.
he says, Frank, do you know this? Do you know that song? And he names a pretty obscure song, you know, by some blues artist. And Frank immediately starts playing it.
Right. Well, Frank was not among other things, he was a student of the blues and R&B and things like that. You know, he was not only he was an aficionado, but he was a student of it as well. And the way Frank was, he would do the detective work. He would do the research and find out who it was that did whatever and you know, things like that. He would find the authors or the people who published or wrote certain songs, etc., and find out where it came from, what the basis of it was, the basis of the theory behind the whatever song it was and where it came from, you know, what its roots were and things like that. I mean, he didn't do anything halfway. Let me put it that way.
Right. Okay, he always talked about, you know, if you want to know stuff, you don't have to go to college, go to the library.
Go to the public library. He was a big aficionado of that and a big believer in that. And, of course, it makes perfect sense.
Let me give you this. So here he is being an employee in an advertising agency in, like, early 60s. And
right.
He may or may not have met Paul Buff yet in Cucamonga. But do you think that he was going to the library and learning all about music, you know, off hours?
Probably.
Back then?
Probably. Yeah, I mean, no, I know he was doing it. I know he was doing it all through high school, grade school, things like that. I mean, if he wanted to know something, he couldn't understand why. Well, what's the, you know, his family, they weren't super well off, but they were middle class.
Yeah.
Because his dad was a nuclear physicist, so, you know, no problem there. But the thing is, they couldn't afford to send everybody to UCLA and then USC and Harvard and stuff like that. Besides, Frank, his concept was, again, why go through all that when I can just go to the public library when all the same books and all by all the same authors and et cetera, are right there in the public library.
Okay. Right. Now, did you see you start there in 78, do you see him go to the library in the late 70s, early 80s?
No, I never saw him do it. I mean, that he had already pretty much arranged it, got his concepts and stuff down, but it wouldn't surprise me to know that he still did it.
Right. He might have got people sent out and got people to bring him stuff.
Sure, sure, exactly.
Yeah, so, yeah, most time I understand he's in the studio in his basement and he's not going out to the library, but you saw him dealing with, you know, non-musical information, books and that. Did he be around in the studio?
Yeah, well, he always had various books and things like that on all sorts of different subjects. You know, before the last tour, I think, or between Thingfish and the last tour, he was coming. He had a concept where he wanted to. He had an invention he was working on, a holographic musical projection system, whereas we could actually play a concert in a soundstage.
Wow.
In a soundstage without leaving. Without having to go anywhere,
broadcast it.
Yeah, broadcast it in full stereo, full holographic stereo, et cetera, you know, which is like wonderful, what a wonderful concept. And he was also applying for the patents on it and working on the patents for it, and that kind of thing. So he'd have books on electronics. Et cetera, et cetera. And also the actual physics of actually achieving this goal, you know. And I'm sure he had also confabbed with various experts in the field as well.
Yeah, calling them up.
Just... Sure, sure. Oh yeah, he would do that a lot. So that's an example of what I'm talking about.
So you saw the books, you saw the patents.
I think he showed me. I think I remember him showing me at least one of the basic patent. In fact, he did. He showed me at least a couple of the basic patent sketches that the concept was based on. So I, which, you know, because he knew I was into science and et cetera, and all that. So, you know, which I thought was very, very cool, which I thought was incredible.
Yeah.
Which I thought was incredible.
Have you ever said that in interviews before?
No, I have not.
Right. So here's Frank. This is what Michael Blake Reed's getting at. The guy could be a scientist. He could be a musician, anything.
Well, sure. That's what I'm saying. Of course he could. He was well-rounded. He was capable of pulling off pretty much just about anything he wanted.
Okay, so being around someone like that, what ideas did you get about his difference or his genius? How did you think about it? Maybe you didn't think about it, but what did you ever wonder what made him like this, or was it just something he was born with? How did you think about it?
Well, I just pretty much resigned myself to the fact that this was, you know, everybody has a talent. Everybody has an ability in
yeah.
this world. And this was, and I would find out more and more what Frank's abilities were, just as he found out about mine, and you know,
right.
cultivated mine and things like that. And the whole time, I'm thinking, I'm a pretty lucky guy. I'm a pretty lucky guy because I've always enjoyed being acquainted with talented people, you know, and things like that. People who had various abilities and capabilities. And, you know, we always ended up being friends with or you know, associates with people like that all my life. And in my case, I consider this yet another one of those instances where I was a lucky guy and being able to, and stumbling on to,
right.
Actually being lucky enough to be in the right place at the right time with a guy like Frank.
Yeah, now that throws new light on the Uncle Mitzenero, the evil scientist. I mean, people don't know about his invent. They knew he could, like, I think he made the first fuzz tone guitar or the fuzz pedal. He did talk about different little gadgets he invented. And
sure.
But to talk about a hologram, a new form of broadcasting, I mean, that's
exactly.
major thinking. That's not known, but that would be part of the satire of writing about himself
oh, yeah.
as an evil scientist.
Oh, and he was. He was a mad scientist. He was always thinking. He
yeah.
was always thinking. And the thing is, that's one thing. When he passed, I was really upset about, man. I was going, man, what just the things that he was working on
yeah.
and thinking about and coming up with and just, but basically he was always in the process. Always in the process of making things better or improving things or you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
He was always in that process of development. You know, he never sat still. He never sat still for anything.
Yeah, and that's...
Which I thought was great.
Yeah, and that's another meaning of himself calling his activities a laboratory. I mean, it's not a metaphor for making music. It's technically what he was inventing.
That's pretty much what he was doing. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, and
you know, because basically his whole place was his whole workspace and et cetera, it was a laboratory, you know? I mean,
yeah.
he always had a lab downstairs at the studio and you know, that and he had his guys building stuff and modifying things like that. He always did that.
Right. When I go back to the ESP point, this idea of synchrony, where he would put, you know, one element from one concert and another element from another concert, and he wanted them to be dissonant, he said, or not
yes.
match, but or overlay and then sync up. And he said often they would sync up, so he called that strange synchronization. He didn't expect it or he wasn't trying to get it. Now, I take, you know, that's one way to he explains synchrony. Now, think of his interaction with social reality, and he would notice the strange synchronization of something he made then showing up in public.
Sure.
Did you ever have discussion on that level about synchrony?
Well, I'd never heard the term before. He had never used it with me, but we did discuss things like that because he was heavily into Charles Ives. He was heavily into Verez, things like that. I loved Charles Ives because Ives would do things that were... Once again, he's the guy that would have a marching band come down come down one street and come and one coming from another street playing two different songs, and then meet and intersect at the intersection of a city block while they're still playing, and then march through each other. That kind of thing. He was heavily into concepts like that, and it showed in his music.
Yeah, environmental stuff.
Sure.
I mean, two environments. So Ives could be said to was studying Xenarchrony, bringing clashing environments together and seeing what happened. I mean, Ives did that. Okay, so then did he ever talk about medicine in his theories? Because he does mention in my interview, he talks about advertising just makes everybody worry about this or that. Oh, you're going to get this. He understood the basic fear thing of the ad and medical world. Did he ever go into any particulars about that with you?
No. Actually, not, because we talked about mostly politics and
did he talk about? Okay, and what?
Politics, you know, current events, things like that. You know, that's mostly that, because that was my field. That was my field of study. That was in my wheelhouse. So, that's
right.
Something that we concentrated on a lot, just between me and him.
Okay, what about this? In an interview, he says there's the mafia, which equals the CIA, which equals the Vatican. And did he ever talk about that kind of stuff with you?
A little bit every now and then.
Did he have any personal experience in his early years in the mafia running clubs, or ever refer to that?
Oh, I'm sure. Of course. I mean, after all, you know, it's a part of his culture as well. So, he did discuss, like, you know, club owners and the guys behind the club owners and things like that. So he did. You know, every now and then he would kind of mention back when he was starting out as a band and being able to get into clubs and things like that. That's, you know,
He talks in his own autobiography. He talks about he found out that a lot of the Freak Out albums were, you know, stolen and put in a warehouse or something. Did you ever hear that topic?
No, actually I didn't.
Yeah, that's. You didn't read his autobiography, or you didn't, don't remember that?
Which one? You're talking about the real Frank Zappa book?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I had it. Actually, it's still in storage and stuff. When I finally got a copy of it and whatnot, and then a lot of our stuff got trapped in storage, so that got lost. But I read like the first quarter of it.
Right. Well, so, yeah, you missed that story. Well, there's another documentary where Frank... they're interviewing the bodyguard, John Smothers.
John Smothers, yes.
Yeah, and Smothers saying, you know, people don't understand how Zappa got the success he got. They think he's a front or was helped by the mafia. And he lists off a couple. Yeah, that's what John says. And I thought about that. Okay, now if you look at the 200 Motels poster, Frank presents the Mothers as a bunch of Hell's Angels, you know, for the movie poster.
Right.
Now, in your own personal experience, you know, Zappa's a very gentle person. He's almost a softy. But he knew that they were seen as ugly and dangerous, the Mothers.
Exactly.
And so he enjoyed that niche, I guess you could say, because he went around saying, ugly can be beautiful. He was actually...
Exactly.
Showing that what people thought were outsiders weren't necessarily what the media presented them as. But I thought it was interesting. I never heard that before until John said that some people, you know, just mistook his image as a tough guy and thought, well, obviously the mafia is behind him.
I see. That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
That was never been my impression, because I told him once that he was just a teddy bear.
Pushover.
He's one of the nicest guys I'd ever known, you know. And he goes, shh, don't tell anybody that, you know. I gotta keep up my image. You know?
Yeah.
That's the thing, because, you know, sentimental slob teddy bear. That's what I called him.
Right. Okay. So then, looking into, let's see. the energy he had, the ability to think and make things. He's obviously an expanded Renaissance man, you know, 20th century level.
Oh, no doubt.
Now, in March 89, the Pons and Fleischmann cold fusion got announced. And,
oh, yeah.
And there was rumors in some kind of press that Frank was interested in talking to Pons and Fleischmann. Now, this is after he's told you he has cancer in January 89, and you may not have got a chance to talk to him for a while. But did you ever hear him talk about cold fusion later?
No, I didn't, because I was into that myself. I mean, I've always been highly interested, especially in cold fusion.
Right.
As opposed to fission.
Right. So you had not, it never came up that Frank was interested.
No, I mean, because by the after he was sick and stuff, whenever we talked, we didn't have a lot of time to you know, talk like we used to, because, you know, he was in a lot of pain, and he would get tired easily and things like that, you know.
Yeah. So if one looks at Frank, you see, you're in the audience, you see Frank there conducting the band, and he's rather efficient looking and like really listening well. But if we actually thought of him as a that on in his mind are he's thinking of new inventions and new hologram, it's a different way of looking the guy if you know that as he's on the stage. You know what
well,
I mean?
Yeah, that's how I always looked at him, because I would pretty much just wait for him to do something with whatever we were doing, even though it may have been something that we've been rehearsing on for months and months and months. He would always find a way to modify it or change it or mold it into something else on the fly. I mean, he did it every night. He did it every night, and I would watch him and try to suss out the process by which he was doing that. I mean, that's the thing. I learned a little bit how to do it, you know, just for my own for my own benefit, and also just as a performer and as a composer and as a musician. But the thing is, you know, I could never figure out the actual process. You know what I'm saying? But I was definitely glad to be there, you know, being able to observe it and to be able to adapt myself to it as well. And to be able to use it myself in some small way.
Right,
you know?
But
it works. Let me tell you something. Bobby, it works. It works. It doesn't always work. Well, actually, there is no right or wrong, but because it does work, it may not be as successful as first conceived, but the thing about it is, but then you adapt. I learned that you adapt and adjust from there, even that.
Right. You're saying, when you say it worked, the ability to respond and change your playing or something. Is that what you're saying?
Sure. Oh yeah. The performance, the playing, the tone, the whatever. You know, it's in one way or another, you can make things like that work for you.
Right. And you found you couldn't do it as fast as Frank.
Well, no, not necessarily as fast. Sometimes I could. Sometimes I couldn't.
Right.
Because it's different every time.
Right.
You know, every performance or every attempt or every performance, et cetera, is different each time you do it. Each night, you know, each night you do it.
But you're saying it works. I mean, one wouldn't think normal musical bands wouldn't think to leave themselves that open. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. Yes. Precisely.
They'd be insecure and have to stay with the scheduled routine.
Oh, yeah. No doubt.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
I want to digress. Here's another way to bring out some information. I want to mention as many band members as I can remember, and have you tell me what their particular talent was? What stands out? What was the useful or the good thing about them? If I say Steve Vai, what was he unique about? What did he contribute?
His musical ability, great ears, great ears, very, very great dexterity.
Okay, you're saying his dexterity, his ability, and great ears is to respond to the changes Frank improvises. Is that what you mean?
Even that, yes. Because the thing about it is, see, Steve has nice, he has like long, skinny fingers and big hands. Okay?
Right.
And that helps him a lot. Okay, that aids him a ton in his guitar playing and his approach to guitar playing. And see, that's real important.
So he had that advantage and he capitalized
yes.
on it. Is what you're saying?
Oh yeah, because see, I've got big hands, but I've got short. I've got relative to Steve, I've got short, stubby fingers.
Right.
So.
Yeah.
That's why I play a Stratocaster, but it's still, but I make it work for me.
Right.
Put it that way. I make it work for me.
Okay. If I say Chad Wackerman, what strikes you about him?
Huh?
Chad Wackerman. What was his?
About Chad?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, Chad. Chad is Chad's got a. He's got a great sense of tonality. You know, the way he plays is much different from Vinny, let's say.
Yeah.
Because Vinny has the combination of speed, dexterity. Vinny's an octopus, just like Tommy Mars. They can play with all four appendages independently of each other in different time zones, which is very, very rare. Chad is not as good as that as Vinny.
Right.
But he makes it work. He makes it work in a different manner. Let's put it that way.
Is tone timbre? Timbre?
Yeah, timbre. Yes, as well. As
okay.
Well. Yes, yes, and it's more. He has a more of a tonal, more of a tonal scale.
Okay. How about Bobby Martin? What stood out about him?
Bobby, on the other hand, he's a vocal. Well, actually, Bobby as well. Now, Bobby, most people don't know that Bobby just does. He doesn't just sing. Bobby plays not only keyboards, but he plays trumpet, French horn, saxophone, as well as being a vocalist.
Yeah.
What else? I mean, Bobby plays every instrument on the face of the earth. Alpine horn.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, Bobby is so wildly talented. Also, he's a great songwriter. He's a great arranger, okay? His vocal, I've heard some of his solo stuff. His vocal arrangements are incredible, okay? And he's a student of R&B and all kinds of music.
Yeah, because he grew up with that. He grew up in Philadelphia,
In Philadelphia, yeah. He's played on, like, the OJs,
yep.
and Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes, and all the old famous Gamble Huff stuff, the Sound of Philadelphia stuff, all that stuff. Okay, and he was on all of those hit recordings. Stuff,
yeah,
you know, Backstabbers, everything. The
OJs, as a young kid.
As a kid, yeah, as a kid, which is incredible.
Yeah.
And so that's what Bobby brought to the table. Arthur Barrow, he was another musical octopus. Artie is one of the smartest people I've ever met. You know, he could. That's why he says a great producer and a great bass player and a great guitar player. You know, and a great writer and a great songwriter and a great producer.
You're saying he's a very smart in the musical world. Is that what you're saying?
Artie, all of these guys, I've found that they're very smart in the musical world and in the so-called regular world.
Right.
For example, Bruce Fowler is the oldest of the Fowler brothers, but Bruce is also a mathematician and a geologist. That's what his degree is in, okay? He was he taught geology for a while.
Wow.
As well as math. Walt Fowler, same thing, but he taught, I can't remember what his specialty was, but I mean, all of them, everybody has everybody that I've been associated with Frank and everything like that, totally multi-talented, you know, and no, by no means one-sided, by no means.
You mean mini Franks?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Pretty much. Hey, misery loves company, you know what I'm saying? I mean, that's what you you got to have. You know, why not be? Why wouldn't Frank surround himself with people who were at least reasonably similar to his abilities?
Yeah.
So he could just say something or give instructions or whatever, and know that, or at least be relatively certain that that it was going to happen the way he wants it to happen.
Right. So,
right.
So Bobby Martin is like a not a full generation, but half a generation later version of Frank,
right,
in the sense he was involved in the industry early.
And to a certain extent, all of us are, at least the people that I just named, that just reeled off that list of people.
Right.
To a certain extent, all of us are. Okay, Vinny and I, we're like a full generation behind after Frank, but,
yeah,
you know, to a certain extent, we all were, because that's basically what Frank was looking for. He's basically looking, what he was very good at, pulling out those abilities from the people that he hired and associated with.
Okay.
Knowing that, or at least having a relatively good idea that he could get these results based on his way of thinking and his concepts of achieving things, he would basically hire band members based on his observations and his concepts and his theories about of way of doing things, you know, and he got pretty damn good at that too.
All right, so if we think of some of the older members, maybe you didn't play with them enough, but what talent did Don Preston have?
God, total genius. Total genius,
yeah.
Electronically and educationally as well. Okay, you know that Don helped invent the Moog synthesizer, do you not?
Yes, I heard about that, and he also influenced John Coltrane, he says.
Yes, he did. And also Preston was he taught, you know, I think he was like a either a mathematician or physics or something like that. I mean, Don, the list is too long for Don. Don is so mentally and scientifically adept at so many things, and just amazing.
He's very like Frank then.
Oh, very much so.
Yeah, and that was the first guy he says in Uncle Meat or somewhere. So they experimented with charts and that abstract music,
exactly,
in the early 60s.
Yeah. Oh yeah, Don is hell with charts, man. He can read any chart. He's, you know, he could teach them. He can, you know, just amazing.
Right.
Just
and,
amazing.
And they used to get together, you know, in 60, 61, 62 in Van Nuys and somewhere around there. And
yep.
Frank would be doing his lounge work with bands, but he would do his abstract work with Don.
With Don, exactly.
Right.
Sure.
Right.
Easy.
All right. What about Jimmy Carl Black? Did he have any particular talent?
Jimmy has a great down-to-earth, just no bullshit way of seeing things and conceiving things. And you know, he could boil the most abstract concepts down to, okay, well, I see it like this. Okay, I mean that's it. I knew Jimmy, great guy and stuff like that. But I didn't know him as well.
Yeah.
As my other brothers in the band, but. You know, he I loved him. He had a great sense of humor, like I said, and a great way of conceptualizing abstract ideas and thoughts into just plain common sense. You know, he was very good at that.
All right.
He was very good at that. Yeah.
What about Roy Estrada?
I don't know Roy as well. I mean, I know him a little bit, but, you know, he just seems to be a fun guy.
Right. How about Ed Marimba? Artie Tripp.
I never met Tripp.
All right. Okay, so we go back into the 70s. Tommy Mars, you've already talked about him, multi-talented. Octopus, is that what you said? Yeah.
Yeah, he's a keyboard octopus. Yes.
All right. Who are we leaving out? Ed Mann.
One of the greatest people on the face of the earth. He was actually the student conductor, the clone meister, when I joined the band. I learned a lot from Ed.
Yeah, I read that recently. I'm surprised. Why would he be the clone? What is the role of the clone meister?
It's the student conductor. When Frank isn't there, there's got to be somebody in charge. You know, to run everybody through the tunes that Frank wants to work on that evening in rehearsal.
Well, you got to know, do you have to be able to conduct?
Well, it helps.
Yeah.
But Ed wasn't that huge a conductor. I mean, I think I'm a better conductor at Ed because I did a cappella choir when I was in boarding school.
Right.
So I learned how to conduct from my choir master.
Right.
But I mean, it's not so much that, it's just being able to interpret what Frank wants musically to the rest of the band and then be able to run the band through the tunes, you know, and the way that Frank wants the way that Frank wanted to hear them.
So Ed has to know his music. He's in the band before you, but not too much earlier, right?
No, just a year or so before me.
But he was able to know the tunes or teach them.
Oh, hell yeah. Oh, yeah, he's a mallet player, man.
Yeah.
He's a mallet player. He has to play impossible stuff, okay, with both hands. Okay?
Right.
So he definitely knew. He definitely knew his theory, his theory and his charts and things like that. You know, he knew his theory and his charts and stuff very, very well. Very, very well.
Okay, now, I saw an interview with him about 96, and
right.
He had gone into the New Age market. He was playing with New Age musicians, what's called New Age music, and he said, actually, I don't think Frank's music is what the world needs now. It was good when it was, and it was cynical and critical, but in the mid-90s, Ed's saying, there's so much chaos and violence going on, we need some kind of soothing level. We don't need criticism. And he was talking this way. Did you ever hear any of that? Do you know what I'm referring to?
No, I don't.
He was the only person. It was a very interesting opinion. He said, you know, Frank's time, his kind of music, incredible genius, and the perfect pitch for his era, but not relevant as you get into the later 90s. Ed had a theory of another kind of music, almost a healing music. That's why he got into the New Age therapy, kind of using sound for therapy.
I had no idea. No, I had no idea at all.
Yeah, and he said, that's what I want to do. I don't want to agitate people, disturb them. I want to soothe them and a healing. And he actually worked in healing clinics. So that's a long time ago.
That's what he's been doing. He still does an occasional clinic as well.
All right. Okay, so we've got Ed, Chad. Mike Keneally is in just in the last year. Any particular talent you want to say about him?
Mike is another, let's say he's another Bobby Martin. Okay, he plays keyboards, guitar, bass, he plays every instrument. He writes his ass off. He's just incredible.
Well, what's coming out of this is that, I don't know if people realize it, I don't think you get as many musical geniuses or musical extra talented people in one band compared to any other band. I don't know if there's...
It's at another level.
Yeah.
At another level.
Yeah, it's like the postgraduates. Like, if you can do complex music and you're interested, then Frank provides that environment for advanced research, almost.
Hey, Pearl, this is the studio. Give me a call, please. Yeah, well, that's the thing.
I said advanced research. Like, for you want interested in advanced research, you want to come to Princeton and hang out with Einstein, then come in our band.
That's what I'm saying, because I used to call it, in the early 80s, I named it Zappa University.
Yeah.
Frank loved it because I wanted to get letter jackets and stuff made, you know, with the Phi Zappa Krappa with the Phi Zappa Krappa emblem on it and things like that, and have like Zappa University have a ZU on the front. Frank thought it was a great idea. I was actually going to do it. That's basically postgraduate work. You know what I'm saying?
Right. Listen to this.
That's grad school.
Yeah. I was thinking, okay, Zappa University. I was thinking this a minute ago. Okay, that's ZU. That's the Grand what zoo? What zoo? What?
Pretty much, yes.
Yeah.
That's really not far off the mark at all.
It's a zoo, and we don't even know what zoo it is.
It's not that far off the mark at all.
Right. Now Frank talks about you talk about, He said, Ray, Ike, have fun. Have fun. You know,
right.
I'm not doing this unless we're having fun. That was his prerequisite.
Yeah, exactly. No, that was the total prerequisite. It's like if you're not having fun because it's if you're not having fun doing this, then you're in the wrong band. That
right.
That was number one. That was the number one prerequisite.
Yeah, it's like in the he had the book of the Church of the Subgenius. You know, when I was there in '88, and don't know how much he read it. He says in his autobiography he liked that concept. If he was going to promote any religion, he'd promote the Church Subgenius. But it was all about the church's dogma is to get slack. Now, everybody's trying to figure out what slack is, but to get slack. He had a very slackful approach to making music, you know, like, let's have slack above all, and which means have fun.
Exactly.
In other words, can you imagine, Frank, if he never got a recording contract and no public, you couldn't stop him. He'd be doing it anyway, sort of like Harry Parch out in the desert or something, right?
Well, basically, he did do it anyway.
Yeah.
Because at the time he got at the time he got signed and things like that, you know, if it hadn't been for Tom Wilson over at Verve Records,
yeah,
right. If it hadn't been for Tom, you know, giving him a chance, you know, nobody would have ever heard of him. But he had already been on the Steve Allen Show.
Yeah.
He's been, you know, you see what I'm saying? And he still found a way to get out there.
That's right. He said once around the early 70s that if he didn't make it in the music industry, he would have been a pretty good film editor.
Oh, yeah. Oh, he's a great film editor.
Right.
Fantastic film editor.
Yeah. Now, in Pauline Butcher's new book, you know, The Secretary to Frank from 67 to 72, at the beginning, she meets Frank at the hotel the first night, and there's a black guy that she meets on the elevator going up, and he gets off at another floor, and then she finds the right place, and then all of a sudden the black guy shows up, and then he comes in, and Frank knows him, and it's Tom Wilson, okay?
Yep.
So they had met earlier, coincidentally, somewhere, and then they meet again in the elevator, and then they're in the room finally together. And he, at one point, when Frank was around, she was leaving, and he said, stick with this guy, Frank. He's a genius. He's going to go far. He actually predicted that. Tom Wilson said that to her. I didn't know what Tom thought of Frank. Like, Frank joked that he thought he was getting an R&B band, you know, when he heard them at
right.
the Whiskey Go Go, and then it was something else. But and then he wondered, well, maybe Tom was, well, I'm stuck with this guy. But no, he actually told Pauline. He said, this guy's a genius, and he's saying that in the summer of '67 or so.
Yeah, but that's the thing. Yeah, that was the joke that I heard. You know, that was the basic concept of the joke that I heard that
Wilson made a mistake.
Right, that Wilson made a mistake. He thought it was an R&B band, but it turned out to be Frank Zappa and the Mothers. But I'd heard all sorts of things about Tom Wilson, about what kind of guy he was and stuff. And
oh, what did you hear on that? What did you hear?
Well, no, just he was a very sharp guy, a very perceptive guy, and he was no fool.
Right.
He knew what he was doing.
Right. So yeah, I never heard anything about him, and now to know that he said that, Pauline, we know that he knew what he was doing. It wasn't an accident.
Yeah, he was no idiot. I mean,
yeah.
Look, he would not have signed Frank unless he thought that there was something there.
Right.
Right. I mean, come on, let's think about this. He would not have signed Frank unless he thought in his own mind in his own heart of hearts that there was something worth signing for.
Yeah, and he may have,
especially in those days.
Yeah, he may have made a passing remark to Frank that he was a bit surprised, but and then Frank, taking the absurdity of it, expanded it, exaggerated into this huge thing. But
sure.
You know,
exactly.
For the humor reasons.
Sure.
Okay, now what about Ray White? What's his talent? What's his talent?
Vocally, just great range. Great range, great talent, great sense of humor, you know, and also he writes a pretty mean song as well.
Yeah.
You know, and he's pretty prolific at it. He writes songs all the time. Actually, when we're on tour and even when we're in the bus, you know, he brings his laptop along and he's constantly writing songs and stuff. But very quick on his feet musically, humor wise. And things like that. I mean, after all the years we've been, after all the years we performed together and stuff like that, you know, he's pretty sharp.
Okay, now, I spoke to him in London, you know, at the Project Object show there, and he was touring with someone else. Do you know who that was? Is?
When was this?
When were we there? In Zappanau, August. This August.
He was touring with somebody else.
Oh, later in the fall. It was like, I don't know, Yes or some band, Queen or something.
I can't remember who it was. I can't remember who he was. Maybe KVHW. It could be KVHW.
Right. So he did work with other bands.
Oh no, always. Yeah. He always works with other bands.
Okay. So have we missed anybody? Drummers, Chester Humphreys. Those guys were before your time, right?
Yeah. Chester and Ralph. But I've played with Chester and Ralph as well. And
okay.
Just great guys. Chester is amazing. Ralph is amazing. I have nothing but total respect for those guys, because those are the guys I listened to when I was cutting my teeth.
Right.
In college, you know, and getting from becoming familiar with Frank's music. Frank's newer version of Frank's music in the 70s, you know, because I was in boarding school the whole time.
Yeah.
Starting with the Roxy album.
Yeah.
So that's Chester and Ralph were the drummers then, which was just amazing.
All right. What about Napoleon Murphy Brock? What talent does he have? Main talent.
He's a performer. Let's say that. If there's, you know, he should be on Broadway.
He's a ham. You're saying he's a ham.
Yes. Thank you very much. I'm glad you said it. Yes. Yes. He's a total ham, but he makes it work for him. He makes it work for him, and he's good at it. So
yeah.
There you go.
What about Ruth Underwood? I mean, we know she was talented.
No. Talented doesn't cover. Talented is an understatement when it comes to Ruth.
Mm-hmm.
Ruth is the queen of percussion. She has the most amazing thing I've ever seen with two hands. Okay.
Yeah.
I didn't think that it was possible for a human being to play marimbas and xylophones and percussion instruments like that. Okay. I didn't think it was possible.
Wow.
Until I saw Ruth on the Roxy tour. She is like a game changer. She is just amazing. Just totally amazing.
So again, you got all these incredibly talented people that end up with Frank. I mean, that's pretty lucky on Frank's part that these people were available.
Well, lucky and also perceptive. Like I said, Frank, you know, he would be in a city or an area or something like that, and basically, you know how it goes. You know, you hear about people, or Frank was at the point where he got into the level where people would tell him about certain people.
Right,
as well.
Right.
You know, or pass the word along, or hey, Frank, you know, I heard this kid, blah blah blah, okay, and things like that, and the word would come around, like Steve Vai, basically somebody called Frank and said, I heard about this kid, you know, I heard about this kid.
Like Adrian Ballou, he discovered in a club. But what was Adrian Ballou's talent?
Yeah. He saw Adrian in a club.
Yeah. So what would you say was Adrian's feature?
Adrian's amazing. Adrian's totally amazing. Great guitar player, great performer, great singer, et cetera, et cetera.
All right. Now there was Denny Wally. Was he in the band when you were there?
Yes, he was.
What would you say?
Amazing. Power slide guitar, amazing vocal range, incredible sense of humor, just amazing.
Okay, now, did you have much interaction with Don Van Vliet?
Not a whole lot. There was not a whole lot of interaction, but I did associate with him a little bit.
So what did you make of him? Was this when he was, this would be later when he's moving towards painting?
No. Psychic and just an amazing guy.
Have you heard of the book by John French or Drumbo? He details, you know, meticulously the ups and downs.
No, I didn't. Huh? No, I didn't. Now Don was just an amazing psychic guy. You know, and he was very, very perceptive. Just a second. Just a
okay.
Second. So anyway, you know, no, Van Vliet, he was there when I was doing the Joe's Garage album, okay? And when I had to do, you know, the song Lucille?
Yeah.
Well, I did it at 2 o'clock in the morning, and Don was there, and Frank was there, and Denny was there. And we went upstairs to do, to get some coffee while Frank was changing tapes, right?
Yeah.
And Don went upstairs with me. And he was just learning, getting to know me and stuff. And I was a little nervous because this was my first album. And we were drinking coffee, you know, out of those styrofoam cups.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I was opening up a brand new bag. Of cups. And just as I was pouring the coffee in it, Van Vliet tells me, "Don't use that cup. It's defective." As soon as the coffee hit the cup, it started leaking out of a hole in the bottom of it. And then Frank called me from downstairs to come down and do Lucille, my first take.
Wow.
Yeah, that's how it happened. That's how most of Joe's Garage happened. Bob, hold on a second.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was my first album, and I was first. That was my first album, and it was, you know, great.
Now you couldn't. Now Don couldn't see a hole in the cup. He probably did. He see something defective?
No, dude. This was a brand new. This was a brand new bag of styrofoam coffee cups.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Unopened. It was in the break room closet upstairs at Village Recorder. Okay. And Don, meanwhile, Don was sketching. Meanwhile, Don was sketching on his pad while he was talking to me, telling me, "Hey, look, man, I think you got a good thing going here. Don't be nervous and stuff. Frank is a great guy, and he really digs you." Okay, that's what Denny and Van Vliet were telling me the whole time. Okay, so.
And then he says, "Oh, by the way, the cup's defective."
No, he said basically, and I quote. Don't use that cup. It's defective.
Wow. It's before
okay.
You put anything in it.
As I was... Yeah, no.